regarding the idea of humanity. When people say, well, he's only human, or she's only human. And I remember specifically several years ago when that term was used in regards to then, at that time, President Bill Clinton. In the late 90s, when he was undergoing great scrutiny for the things that he had done, either with this woman or other acts of immorality that was he was charged with. And there were so many people, whether it was the TV media or the talk shows or his own Democratic Party was coming along and saying, well, he's only human, he's only human. And we use that phrase quite a bit. But I want to just dissect a little bit what this word only human means. But first of all, pointing out the word only. This word only modifies that word that's right connected to it. And when we say only human, then there's a tendency to use that word as a way to minimize the importance or the significance of something. As if to say that whatever that is only is just really doesn't matter a whole lot. Therefore, I give you this illustration is, don't be afraid, it's only me. As if to say, maybe if it was more than me, you might want to be afraid. But it's only me, so there's no reason to be afraid. And then sometimes when they talk about it in the papers or in the news, they talk about all those particular tragedies that happen, especially when it comes to minors. There were, of the 300 minors, only one died. And then sometimes people talk about reference to the spirituality of their children. Of all five children, only one is not a Christian. Only one is not a Christian. And then we use that word in a lot of other attempts. In other words, take the sting out of some mistake or some bad decision or some choice that we've made. And then we'll say, well, so what? I blew $300 in gambling. It's only money. It's only money. And then some people talk about their married life. And they'll say, well, I've been married for 45 years and I only cheated one time. And then some folks talk about worship. And they'll say, well, I worship all the time only, and I don't do it only when I work or when I go on vacation. And they use that word only to minimize their actions. And really to say what's going on, it's really not that significant. It's really not that important, and it's really not something anybody ought to be concerned about. Well, let me just attempt to give you an understanding that when we talk, and I've mentioned this already, but there's something about that word only found in John 3:16. If our mentality is that the word only is really not of any significance and there's not really importance placed to it, then what does John 3:16 mean? In our thinking, where it says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. If we are looking at these mistakes, sins, bad choices, as it's only, and we minimize that, then this one is just as insignificant. Got to be in the context of what we use. Well, let's go a little bit further. Not only talk about he is or she is only human, talk about the word human. If he is only human, then what's the significance of that? With the word human, there's this negative tone that's associated with it. It's a matter of presenting some idea of weakness because that's who we are. It expresses the failings of the people that have been, in many cases, where we want or we have accepted those failings and those mistakes and those things that they've done that haven't really measured up. And they, as a result of that, they become to be things that we've just basically accepted that they're doing. And there's nothing that can be done different. Well, to say he's only human, we've got to understand what it was that God did in the very beginning in Genesis chapter 1. You've got to recall this. Because in Genesis 1, verse 26 and 27, what did God do? He made humans. But then when he made humans, the significance is not so much that it's flesh and blood, animalistic as we might say, but the significance is the divine image in which he put within that human. Therefore, you can't just minimize that and talk about, well, to err is human and talk about human feelings and human conditions and present this idea that this weakness and this failing, and even though these choices haven't really measured up, then really it's kind of sort of helping ease our way into doing what we want to do. In Genesis 1, 26 and 27, this is what God put within us, this image within us. So to use this word only, human, to kind of minimize something and say it's insignificant, and then come along and use the word human to, in essence, even minimize it more, to say this is just flesh and blood, then boy, we've really done a lot of damage to what God really wanted us to be, and we really put an insignificant point on what it is that he's done in us, this image that he's placed within us. All we're doing when we talk about this idea of he is only human or she is only human, we're contributing to the point of unfaithfulness. We are contributing to the idea that people really need to be nothing more than lazy or indifferent or passive, and they really don't need to find themselves doing any better than what they're doing. And it's almost like we've defeated ourselves before we even started out. We give precedence to the idea of the drunk who's just willful, does what he wants to do, and this atheist is says, well, I'm just as good as they are because we're only human. So you see what we've done with this? You see what we've done with that? But the big question is, why is it that we've done that? To say we're only human? It gives everybody the reason to sin. It just contributes even more to this. They just keep doing it over and over. But why is it that people would say nobody's perfect? Or he's only human or she's only human? Let me give you a few examples and reasons why. First one is, people have lowered the standard. It's all way down. I'm sure that some of you have, or you've seen, these basketball goals that have this adjustment bar to it, that it goes from 10 feet down to, I don't know, 6 feet, something like that. It can be adjusted all the way down. Now, for a little boy that's 6 or 7 years old, bringing it down to 6 feet is wonderful. That way, he can score just about every time he shoots it. And for a 13-year-old or 14-year-old boy, what does that do for him? That enables him to slam dunk. I mean, you put a goal down to 6 foot, man, he's going to turn around and he's going to be Air Jordan and he's going to slam it down. He's going to do everything he can to be like LeBron James at every point. And he's going to shoot what? He's going to shoot 100% every single time. If he's practicing on that, then it comes, let's say, Saturday, and he's in the city league, and he's shooting a 10-foot goal. What's going to happen? He's going to miss every shot. He can't even make it. He can't even touch the rim, much less the net. So now you've already defeated him when you've got him a standard up here that he can't make because you've already let him practice on something that really makes him feel good. Makes him feel good about himself. But I remember when I was young, we only had one goal, 10 foot. And I remember going with my dad when we went to the community center. And I was a little boy. And I tried my best to take this heavy thing called a basketball and shoot it up to the goal. And I couldn't even touch the net. And it took me a long time to touch the net. And then I touched the bottom of the rim. And when I touched the bottom of the rim, I thought, man, I was getting close. But then when I got over the rim, and then it went through the net, I finally find myself coming to the point I've reached the standard. I've come to the point of exactly what it was I'm supposed to do. We have eased our standards. We've lowered the standards because it's easier than raising it. If you raise a standard, you're killing me. You're messing me up. You're messing my style. You're ruining the way that I'm supposed to be doing things or the way that I want to do things. I want to shoot 100%. And the only way I'm going to shoot 100% is to do it the way I want to do it, at the standard which I want to have it, not raise it up to 10 feet. We'll look and see what the scriptures say. God raised life standard when he said in John chapter 12, verse 48, through the words of Jesus, these are the words that will judge you. When he said in Romans chapter 2, verse 16, the words that I speak, these will be the ones that will judge you. This is what's going to, you're going to give account to this. Revelation chapter 20, verse 12, these words. You see, God's the one that has set the standard. The world is not the standard. They'll lower the goal just so that you will find it pleasing. Romans chapter 12, verse 2 says, conform not to this world, neither the things that are in this world. The world is something that you don't conform yourself to. You transform yourself from that. Conform not to this world, neither the things that are in the world. Why not? Because it's a standard that's not acceptable. But yet we look at this world and we see this standard, and then we look and see what God says. We say, well, we're a step above the world. Maybe they curse 20 times a week, but maybe I just do it 4 times a week. We look at the standard and we say, well, they may tell a lie 10 times a week, but I don't do it but maybe 3. We set this standard here. Maybe they get drunk once a month, but I only get drunk once a year. Maybe they curse every breath, but I only curse only when I get upset and get uptight. Therefore, we use an irrelevant standard to bring ourselves to the point of accepting something that really isn't true. Therefore, we come along and say, well, we're only human. Nobody's perfect. The reason people say nobody's perfect is because they compare themselves with other people, with others. Just like the book of 2 Corinthians chapter 10 says, when he talks about 2 Corinthians 10 verse 12, regarding other people, he says, for we are not bold to number or compare ourselves with a certain of them that commend themselves, but they themselves measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves with themselves are without understanding. The comparison that we make with others is another false standard. We only come to their expectation or to what we see them do. We make comparisons and justifications of ourselves based upon all these other people and what they're doing. Oh, we'll look at ourselves and say, well, I may not study the Bible every single day, but I'll tell you what, at least I'm not like David is when he doesn't get his lesson. At least I study the Bible every so often. And then we say, well, you know, maybe my clothes aren't modest, but at least I don't look like Lady Gaga. We kind of compare ourselves with everything else and everybody else that's going on. I may not be able to control my anger, but I tell you what, at least I haven't killed anybody yet. Compare ourselves with Jesus. Here's this comparison. Here's the standard. Because as Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 1, be ye imitators of me, even as I also am of Christ. The measurement, like it's stated in the book of Philippians chapter 4, the measuring stick is what? The measuring stick is Jesus Christ. He says in Ephesians 4, verse 13, until we all attain to the unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, unto a full-grown man to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, that we be no longer children, tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine. Here's the standard. This is it. That's why 1 Peter 1, verse 15, verse 16 says, be holy even as I am holy. In reference to God. There's the standard. But people lower it. People compare themselves with others. And as a result, that's why they're saying nobody's perfect. Or he's human or she's human. And then there's this other reason. We say these things and we think this way because we limit what God has not limited. In 1 John chapter 1, verse 7, that Wade read to us just a moment ago, there's something that is stated in that verse I think we need to really point out that is of value to us. In 1 John 1, verse 7, he says this, but if we walk in the light as he's in the light, we have fellowship one with another, and the blood of Jesus, his Son, cleanseth us from all sin. We are able to walk in the light. We are able to do this. We got the capability of doing this. And we can't come along and say, well, I can't do that. Philippians chapter 4, verse 13, I can do all things through Christ that strengthens me. We can't come along and say, well, I can't do what I'm supposed to do. But yet, Philippians 4, verse 13 says, yes, you can. It is so important that we understand that God is never presenting to us a standard that's lower than perfection. And as a result of him doing that, then the first thing we think of, well, God's perfect and we never reach that point and there's no reason for us to even go there. Well, look at it from this standpoint. Go over to Ephesians chapter 4. Look at Ephesians 4 verse 25, for example. In Ephesians 4, verse 25, he says, wherefore, putting away falsehood, speak ye truth, each one with his neighbor. He says, put away the lying. Speak the truth. He didn't say, try not to lie. He didn't say, don't lie often. He said, speak truth with your neighbor. Then you go down to verse 29. He says, let no corrupt speech proceed out of your mouth, but such as is good for edifying, that it may give grace to them that hear. He doesn't say, just try to watch what you say. He doesn't come along and say, well, I want you to understand, I know there's a lot of people that you're around at school and work and all these kind of things that really don't have a good mouth, but just do the best that you possibly can. And if it comes out ever so often, then this just a little bit, it's not like what they're doing. He just says, let no corrupt speech proceed from your mouth. We don't, God's not limiting us, and we limit what God does not limit. And then go back to verse 28 where he says, let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor working with his hands the thing that is good. He doesn't come along and say, here's what you need to do. Whenever you run out of money, and whenever it gets to the point that you're starving, then you better go steal it. If you're really looking for something to eat, and you don't have time to go work and get it, and he doesn't say you don't need to worry about paying back what you owe somebody. He said, let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor. Why do we limit ourselves by saying nobody's perfect? Because we don't want to exercise the self-control that it takes to do what we need to do. That's why. That's why we don't do it. Well, here's something that's vital as well. Why would people say nobody's perfect? Because they're led to believe that we're born in sin. That's the homosexual motto, basically. No responsibility, no accountability. We're born this way. That's their cry. And this false teaching has got to the point where there is this belief that you might as well come along and say, well, we're all human. We're nobody's perfect. And it makes sense. But what did God do in creation? Was God's creation imperfect? No. Genesis chapter 1, verse 31, it was all very good. Therefore, to come along and have this idea that we're born this way is to put a limitation on what God is giving us the opportunity to do. And we're saying that all these babies that are born with a lot of filth. They're not innocent. And you hear people talk about in the context in some cases, well, he's just so innocent or she's just so innocent. How can that be if we come to this point of believing this and say nobody's perfect? What we're doing is we're allowing those people that we say were born this way to say, well, they're just human. They fail. We might as well accept their imperfections. And we cast a shadow upon what God did. Are we all born this way? I mean, we're all born failures. Might as well just quit, defeat. Some might as well just shoot us between the eyes and just get us out of our misery. Is that the way we're supposed to look at this? And we come along and say, well, it doesn't matter what I do because I'm just going to go sin anyway. It doesn't really matter. But when you read the scriptures, is that what we're supposed to come to the realization? Everybody ought to accept your failures because this is who you are and this is the way you're born? Well, look at what the Bible teaches. The reason we come to this point of sin is because James 1, verse 14, 15. We're drawn away by our own lust. The reason we come to the point of sin is we have, Romans chapter 6, 16 through 18, we've chosen to do it. We chose to sin or we chose not to sin. We are either servants of death or sin unto death or of obedience unto righteousness. We've chosen this path. Then when the temptation comes, like 1 Corinthians chapter 1, 1 Corinthians 10, when the temptation comes, we say, open the door, here I come. Or open the door, let me get out of this. One way or the other, we either escape or we go right to it. Christians, what are we? We're born of God. When you look at 1 John chapter 3, he says in 1 John chapter 3, verse 7 to verse 10, he mentions it this way. My little children, let no man lead you astray. He that doeth righteousness is righteous, even as he is righteous. He that doeth sin is of the devil, for the devil sins from the beginning. To this end was the Son of God manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil. Whosoever is begotten of God does no sin, because his seed abides in him, and he cannot sin because he's begotten of God. In this, the children of God are manifest and the children of the devil. Whosoever does not righteousness is not of God. Neither he that loveth not his brother. You see the distinguishing point? We're born of God. This is not what we're called to do. This is not what we kind of default to saying, this is what's going to be. I can't help the situation in which I'm in. Matter of fact, I want to tell you something. My parents did the very same thing. And you ought to expect that I'm going to do the very same thing they do. Is that true? Talk to Josiah about that. In the book of 2 Chronicles 34, oh, my dad was an evil guy, and my granddad, he's worse than that. Ammon and Manasseh. And what he did when he was 8 years old, he began to make a transformation in the people of Israel. Then we got to 16, all these old altars to idols came tumbling down. And then when he was 26, everything was purified. Man, the guy got things going. He didn't resort back to the old days. Or what he grew up in and say, well, I'll tell you what, my mom, dad did this, my grandfather did this, and then you might as well expect me to do the very same thing. He didn't default to his past experiences. Therefore, we can't come along and say, well, my failures are because of what environment I was raised in. It's almost as if to say, we're born this way. I think we would do well to understand that one of the reasons why people come along and say nobody's perfect is because they lightly regard the seriousness of sin. When people are drawn away, like James chapter 1, verse 14, verse 15 says, into sin, when that happens, we've almost got this mentality that we're going to do this. And as a result of that, we see, since there is no perfection in us, we are the people that are going to do this, and sometimes we just lightly regard this whole process of getting there. 1 John 1, verse 8 to verse 10 says, you cannot lightly regard this. As Wade read to us just a moment ago, if we come along and say we haven't done this, then we're lying, and we're deceiving ourselves. It is so important that we understand the tumultuous division and strife that exists because we separate ourselves from God. Like Isaiah chapter 59 verse 1 and verse 2 says, this is a separation. This has alienated us from the person who we need to find ourselves in communion with and united with. Saying nobody's perfect makes people enjoy every sinful step they take. It makes you want to accept it, and you want to make sure that everybody else accepts it. Let me let you think about a couple of examples here that might help us understand how serious this idea of sin is. To eliminate this idea of saying, well, nobody's perfect. First of all, in the case with David and Bathsheba, in the book of 2 Samuel chapter 11, David has committed adultery with Bathsheba. When Nathan comes to him, is the first thing that Nathan says to him, says, I want to tell you something, friend. You're only human. There's a lot of other people that's done the very same thing. Nobody's perfect. I understand why you did what you did. I couldn't. It's hard to believe that a king would do this, but I understand why you did what you did. And walk away and say, I don't know what I can do for you. Nathan comes along and gives him this story in the book of 2 Samuel chapter 12, beginning in verse 1, and goes down at the very end of it. David is upset. David is the one that's upset. And then Nathan comes along to him and says, well, you're the man. You're the man that's responsible. You're the one that's accountable for what it is you're doing. Nathan is horrified at the fact that this king is the one that did it, and he reveres the fact that he's the one that should be representing what's right. You're a public servant. You're a servant of God. You're supposed to be demonstrating something more responsible than what you're doing. And not come along and say, well, the guy's imperfect. The guy's human. He just made mistakes. That's just what kings do. That's not just what kings do. He wanted David to see the seriousness of the sin. And then here's the case in the book of Acts, the second chapter, where the people, after they've heard all the apostles talk about Jesus Christ dying in the tomb, being raised. And then say in verse 36, let all the house of Israel therefore know assuredly that God made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom he crucified. And when they heard this, they were pricked in their heart, and they said to Peter and the rest of the apostles, brethren, what shall we do? That word pricked, in our context is, it's just like getting stuck with a little needle on the end of our finger. It's just like the doctor or the nurse comes in and says, they're going to give you a shot. It's just going to sting a little bit. And if you're afraid of shots, it's not going to sting. You're going to faint. I mean, it's no sting. You're almost dead. So this idea of pricking is a mentality. Well, it's just a thorn. You're just pricked by the thorn on the rose. It's just like getting bit by maybe a little bee. Or it's maybe something like being stung by or bitten by a little ant or a mosquito. It's going to prick a little bit. It's not going to be that bad. But the Greek word for the word pricked here is not, it's going to be a little sting. It's going to hurt a little bit. It's going to be something that really is no significance. This is a word that means struck violently, stunned. Because of the seriousness of their sin, they are absolutely bone-crushing, embarrassed about a life moment that they killed the Son of God. It's a very shaky moment. And they didn't come along and say, well, I want to tell all of you out there, nobody's perfect. I can understand why you did this. If I was in your position, I'd do the very same thing. No rationalization of all this. It's the coming to the realization that you're accountable and responsible for what you're doing. I remember the case in the book of Romans chapter 7 where Paul started talking about it beginning in verse 14 to the end of the chapter about this is what the law says and I know it says this is good and I believe that it's good, but then he says there's something within me that wants to do the bad things. And every time I want to do the bad things, I know I'm not doing the right thing. He goes back and forth and back and forth. And just talking about the warring that's going on in his members. And at the conclusion of it, what does he say? I want to tell all your brethren wrong. We're all only human. We are all going to make mistakes. We've all going to make some bad choices. He came along and said, I thank my God through Jesus Christ, that he's allowed me to be delivered from this awful situation. Showing how serious this idea of sin is. But what is God calling us to do? He's calling us to be perfect. Oh, and then you know what we do? We see this word and we take one step back. And then we say, there's no way you can come to this point. Well, think about this. The word perfect is found in the book of Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 43 to verse 48. At the end of this chapter, verse 40, he says, ye therefore shall be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. But if you were to read verse 43 to verse 47, you would know how he concludes it with that. He talks about regarding love. You can have the same kind of love that God has, which is perfect, by demonstrating that toward not just the people that are good to you, but to the people that are your enemies, verse 44, by praying for them. Perfect love casts out fear, 1 John chapter 4, in the context of verse 16 to verse 21. This is God's call for us to have this perfect love just like he has, and not want anything less than, nor accept anything less than that perfect and complete situation. Not come along and say, well, I can't love my enemies. And I can't have that love. That's found in 1 John chapter 4. This is God's call to us. Then we add this one. And that is faith working toward being perfect. In the book of James chapter 1, this word perfect is written up again. He uses it twice in the same verse. Can it all joy, my brethren, when you fall into manifold temptations, knowing that the proving of your faith works patience. And let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, lacking in nothing. There's that word perfect again. How is it that this idea of perfection is going to come in the midst of these trials, in these hard times in which I'm in. It's a matter of that faith working with your patience. The reason there are a lot of people that are Christians that give up is because they don't have their faith working with their patience. And they don't become to be perfect. They let all these trials, let all these temptations, all these challenges of life get to them. If you were to read all through the book of James, you've got a lot of different subjects there in that book that help you understand how important it is to be perfect or to be complete. Some versions use the word complete rather than perfect. Talks about your neighbor. Talks about faith. Talks about tongue. Talks about patience. And a lot of other subjects that's there. That brings you to the point of being perfect. To say that perfect means sinless, yeah, that's true. But it also means this idea of completeness. And how do you achieve that? Right here. It's found in what we've always emphasized in the book of 2 Timothy chapter 3, 16, 17. We say the Word of God has been inspired. Every scripture inspired of God is profitable for doctrine, reproof, correction, instruction, and righteousness, that the man of God may be perfect or complete, thoroughly furnished unto every good work. And you look at that passage, and it says you can be this through the understanding of the scriptures. Therefore, the conclusion you can come to is that the people that are not perfect, the people that are not complete, are not looking in the scriptures to see what the Word says for them to do. Therefore, they default to nobody's perfect. Wow. That's how this has come about. And the same thing's true here in James chapter 1, where it says in verse 25, but he that looks into the law of liberty, and so continues being not a hearer that forgets, but a doer that works, this man shall be blessed in his doing. The perfect law produces perfect people or complete people. And notice this. He kind of gives you a little stretch of this in verse 26. If any man thinks himself to be religious, while he bridles not his tongue, but deceiveth his heart, this man's religion is vain. That phrase, deceiveth his heart, makes me think of the subject which we're covering. To say, he's only human, she's only human, nobody's perfect. Since they can't control their tongue, they deceive themselves to think that all their religion is just a little screen up in front of everybody else to make them think they're somebody that they're not. And see, that's what we do. Instead of looking to see what it is we're supposed to be doing, we put the screen up to present to somebody a profession that we really don't commit ourselves to. We're not really directed to God, by God. And then we join the crowd, and we say the same things they do. Let me present something to you as we conclude this lesson. Let's just say, well, you know as well as I do, that there's schools around here in this area that have a zero tolerance for either drugs or guns or knives or any kind of violent activity. They have a zero policy, zero tolerance. What does that mean? If you have these things, or you do these things, that means we do not tolerate that. You will be punished. Expelled from school. School suspension for so long, just kicked out altogether. Can't come back the rest of the year. There are certain companies, when it comes down to production, have the same kind of policy. Zero tolerance. No mistakes. No spots. No wrinkles. No blemishes. No kind of errors in this, no flaws, nothing but perfection. What do? They have this quality control unit down to the end of this, that whenever this product comes down there and there's this flaw, there's a scratch, there's this mistake, they scratch it, put it in the pile of all the mistakes, or they send it back and say, we got to do this better. You got to do better with this. There's a zero policy, zero tolerance policy. Therefore, when everybody in the company knows that there's a zero tolerance of these products coming across the line, then there's going to be a minimum amount of mistakes. But let's just say this. Let's just say the company decided that we would have a 5% tolerance. tolerance or an 8% tolerance on mistakes that came along. What do you suppose would happen to the production of all those particular things that they were putting together? What do you think would happen? They would get as close to the 5% or the 8% tolerance level as possible. They wouldn't get below it. They'd get right there at it. You know that as well as I do. That's what they do. Therefore, whatever the level of the tolerance is, that's exactly what people are going to achieve. And the same thing's true with us. When it comes down to being a Christian, when you've got this policy that God's got, and you've got this cop-out method of people saying, well, nobody's perfect, we accept less than the perfect that God has already given to us, we don't take sin seriously, and therefore as a result of that, we're not achieving the holy living that we're supposed to live. Well, it makes a lot of sense to me. It's just like, let's just say you've got this dress or this shirt or this suit or pants that you know is, you spend a lot of money on it. Then you see, all of a sudden you go to some place and you get this spot on it. Maybe you're eating somewhere or there's an ink smudge somewhere. Then you think in your mind, oh, I've got to do something to get that spot out. Well, you take this cleaner and you do all your rubbing and your cleaning and your brushing and all that kind of stuff, and you let it dry, and it's still faintly right there, and you say, I can't wear that anymore, but I paid too much money for this. So you take it to the cleaner, and you get them to do it, and the next thing you know, it really hasn't diminished either. You can still see a little bit. And you say, I paid too much money for this stuff. I just cannot afford to throw it away. I can't afford to throw that coat or that skirt or that dress or whatever away. Then what do? Well, you say, I just can't afford not to wear it, so you just wear it. But then it's visible. It's the stain or the spot, the wrinkle, whatever, it's still visible. And then lo and behold, let's say you come to worship right here. Then all of a sudden somebody comes up and says, nice coat, nice skirt, nice dress, nice shirt. But did you know there's a spot right there? There's a spot right there? Did you notice that? You say, yes, I've tried, I did everything I could. But you know, spots are spots. Spots will be spots. And as a result of that, what you're trying to do is you're trying to get them to accept the fact that spot's there, because you've already accepted it, you paid a lot of money, and you're not going to throw it away, you're just going to keep it. And you're going to let everybody accept the fact that you've got this spot, because you've already accepted this spot. When you look in the scriptures, is that what God is asking us to do? When there's these flaws that's there, these mistakes, these bad choices that we've made, these words that we're saying, and we come along and say, well, that's just the way I am. Nobody's perfect. We're only human. And we gradually, subtly deceive ourselves into thinking it's okay. Then we want everybody else to do the very same thing. When God's already called us to a higher calling than that. Instead of coming along and saying, this is the way it is and I'm only human, why don't we let the person that can really clean it take it to Him? That being Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ, with His blood, wash it away. Eliminate it altogether. And then be like Him. People in the book of Acts were told to repent and be baptized. They weren't told, you're only human, nobody's perfect. They were told to be responsible for what it is that you're doing and act upon what you know is right. So we call upon you this evening to do what's right. While together we sing this song.